Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Hey, good morning. Doug Sinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyer. Is all things legal. Give us a call, 260-1870. Good morning, Albert.
Hey, Doug, what's going on?
Oh, nothing much. Sunday without football. So, well, another, Saints football. Saints football.
FC Championship without the Saints. They've come close times.
Looking at the way things were, as far as, you know, Drew Brees, his condition, I don't think they would have had a very good shot in Green Bay. And I think you know, basically what happened was, I think the league in the last four or five games, when Drew Brees came back, they'd, you know, stack nine on the line and play two deep and say beat us. And, you know, he was just beat up to the extent where he couldn't really accommodate that. So,
right.
You know, that was, you know, it was just tough to watch. But the reality was, it was, if you could say, a one-dimensional passing game, if you could cover the first 10 yards, you were going to do okay. And you could see that was reflected in the statistics. And, you know, the NFL is a copycat league, and, you know, they saw some things probably against Kansas City and, you know, watching film and saying, hey, let's just stack them up at the, you know, players at the line of scrimmage. Now, if you had Taysom coming in one out of every four or five plays, you know, at least he could have stretched it a little bit. I think that hurt. And I think with Taysom, it would have maybe mitigated that. But it is what it is. What do you think about
as bad as it got, they were never going to pull. And as bad as it got, they were never going to pull Drew.
Right,
his final,
right.
So, you know,
this
team went down for the count.
But,
I mean, through one long pass, and it was Jameis Winston, you know.
Well, that poses a very interesting offseason, because do you either re-sign Jameis Winston at a big risk with a big upside at a pretty good price, or do you go after Matthew Stafford? You know, because the primary issue going after Matthew Stafford would be the Saints are in salary cap hell, first of all, because before the pandemic, the salary cap was projected to be about $210 million. Now it's going to be $174 million. And on top of that, the Saints sort of mortgaged or used their credit line for this year. And they're going to have to pay next year. The next 2 years. So
they overpaid for Thomas.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I know he was injured and everything else, but you know, when you do a slant and a seven and out 50 times a game, you're going to catch a lot of balls. You know, if the quarterback's accurate, he'll get it to you. And I think Thomas was the recipient of that in the system. And which is why, if you recall, I was against paying him all that money.
You are.
Let him go somewhere. Go get a Sanders. Go get a somebody else that you can, you know, Traquan Smith was doing great. You know, give me a guy that can throw the ball and you know, lead me a little bit, and I can get some yards after catch. And, you know, I mean, we talk about this all the time, you know, how Terrence Cocker went, and he was a primary, one of the primary receivers for Drew Brees, and he went somewhere else. You never heard from him again. I always forget, but he blanked out of his name, the tight end that, you know, was so good and left and didn't really do anything anywhere
else.
Jimmy Graham, yeah. I mean, your quarterback has a lot to do with how well you play as a receiver, you know, and if it can hit me in stride and it can hit, you know, when all I got to do is catch it. That's why they say that, you know, Odell Beckham, you know, shows how great of a receiver he was, but Eli Manning, on the other hand, obviously was not that great of a quarterback because you never saw Michael Thomas making acrobatic catches because he didn't have to. The ball was, you know, the ball was put in a
Eli won two. Man, you tough, man. Eli won two Super Bowls, man.
There's a sense of accuracy. Look, and at some point you realize, hey, look, I got pressure in my face. I'm going to throw it up there and let Odell make a play on the ball.
Right. No, I get it. I get it. Well, I think the two factors that will – the Saints either have to decide whether we're going to have to get out of the salary cap hell by getting an inexpensive quarterback, which I think they could get Winston for the quarterback market very inexpensively, and that's all relative. Also, too, as far as Stafford's concerned, there's only three draft picks, probably a fourth that's coming in the third round. I think they got first, second, and fourth. And so they don't have a lot of assets. And, you know, a lot of some teams do the opposite, like the Pelicans are doing it. They accumulate a lot of draft picks, like the Patriots do. They trade down, pick up draft picks, trade down, pick up draft picks, so you have a lot of assets
to move.
And the Saints sort of mortgage those assets, to you know, which they did well, getting Alvin Kamara, some Marcus Davenport. You know, they've done that historically, but this year they need those assets would be very helpful to get them out of the salary cap hell, because you can get when you draft rookies, you get a lot of value as far as their salary is concerned.
Well, so look, so you think Mac Jones will be there?
No, not at 28. I don't think so. I think Mac Jones is probably the quick most NFL ready quarterback who could come in. But you don't know. I mean, Darnell came in for the Jets 2 years ago, and I mean he's sort of flaming out. Carson Wentz is flaming out. You don't know how they will translate and how they will sustain themselves. And so it's a big risk. I mean, heck, Drew was a second round pick. Joe Montana was a third round pick. Just because you picked in that top 10, Rosen, who was the number 10 pick for the Cardinals, is out the league right now. But who was at UCLA, came in the same year as Darnell and Deshaun Watson and Trubisky.
Mm-hmm.
So you just don't know how those skills are going to translate. Joe Burrow's done well, but over the long term, it's still to be seen. I think he'll do well, but you just don't know.
And so
it is sort of a crapshoot. As to even if you get the number one pick, you can get a really good quarterback in the second, third round if you do your homework. But you just don't know. And there's certain and I think a lot has to do with the cognitive ability to run an NFL offense is probably the number one. Because, I mean, Drew Brees has very good – he's got great accuracy, and he's a great athlete, but he's not going to run – he's not like a Taysom athlete. He's not like a Deshaun athlete. But basically, he's got it between the ears. And same with Tom Brady. And that's the cognitive aspect of handling NFL as quarterback is which was the key. I will say this about Matthew Stafford. I read the Dallas Cowboy scouting report on Matt Stafford coming out of Georgia, and they said he was the best prospect maybe ever to come out of college as far as his physicals, as his physical attributes. I mean, he is dynamite. Now he's been, you know, he's at Detroit, which was, you know, much like being with the Saints in the 70s. He's got the crud beat out of him. He's probably a little punch drunk, but from a physical standpoint, Matthew Stafford is as good as they are, as good of a quarterback as there is in the NFL.
Been in the league a long time. How much younger is he than Drew?
He's 33. He's got a few years left in him. I mean, he would be a good short-term fix. And one of the things they did say is if you, a first-round pick and possibly a asset, you know, I don't know, Lattimore or a Cam Jordan or Marcus Davenport. I mean, you'd have to give up something significant. And then you got the salary cap issue. So I think it would be a very interesting to see if they could pull it off. And one, like, again, they were expecting the salary cap to be $35 million more than they were before when they were planning last year. Nobody saw the pandemic. Now it's at 174, and you know, it's interesting. And I will say this: I'll probably get in trouble for this. You know, revenues are down, and I think the players are going to start feeling a lot of teams are going to cut a lot of players and demand to be renegotiate their contracts. And most of it's due to the pandemic, but a lot of it is, you know, before you alienate a large portion of your audience, the players may think in the future, you know, when I do alienate them because I want to give them my, some maybe informed or uninformed political beliefs, that it may hit me in the pocketbook, which will be interesting in the future. So, you know, that's something that's probably not talked about, but it is probably on, you know, a definite factor. But all right, well, we got Jimmy on. Let's go to a break, and then I think Jimmy's still on the line, and he's got a question, so we'll be right back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, Your Weekend Lawyers, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout.
Hello.
Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, Your Weekend Lawyers, All Things Legal. Let's go to phone. Well, first of all, before we go to Jimmy, just the federal government has extended its eviction moratorium till March of this year. And I think Jimmy wants to call us, so he's got a question regarding eviction. Hey, Jimmy, you're on All Things Legal with Doug Cinceri and Albert Nico.
Yeah, I have some concerns about, actually, I'd like to know the status of the federal eviction moratorium, and when does that extend through, and what is the status of New Orleans moratorium?
Well,
this affects a lot of, like, you know, I buy a double and I'm going to use half of the other side to pay my note, and next thing you know, you can't evict a tenant, you know, who's going to pay, like, a, you know, 30-year note or something like that.
Well,
so I think it's going to a lot of heartaches for little mom and pops and just, you know, single realtor, you know, investors.
Well, first of all, I think it goes through March. And Albert, I want, you know, you can speak to this too. Here's the misperception if you read how this is presented in the media or by government, is that 90% of landlords are, quote, mom and pop investors. And in the sense that, for example, we just did a couple of leases for a couple in New Orleans who worked for the mail service for 40 years. And instead of having a 401k, they took their 401k money and bought three doubles, which would be in essence their 401k. That would pay, you know, that would pay their monthly expenses upon retirement. And they're not receiving rent right now. And so I think, you know, this story, while it is very concerning that of the inability to pay for a lot of landlords, even with, you know, some had the government benefits and chose not to pay because of the moratorium. But the other side of this, you do not have, like, It's a Wonderful Life, Mr. kind of landlords who own thousands and thousands of, you know, of units and sitting on a pile of money and, you know, and can afford to not have payments. And, you know, Albert, you can speak to that.
Well, you know, there are some steps that they have to go through, Jimmy. They have to fill out a form, and it's a certification that, A, they are unemployed, or they have become unemployed. B, they have a certain income threshold. They can't make more than like 80% of the median area, that kind of thing. So, I mean, they have to take positive steps before you can evict them. Now, you know, at some point, you know, you're going to tell them, hey, look, you've got to fill out a form. You know, where is your form? Confirming that you qualify to the rent moratorium. I mean, over the eviction moratorium. And so, if you take those steps ahead of time, and they don't provide you with anything, then at that point, I think you would have grounds to go to the clerk of court, for the parish court if you're in Orleans Parish. I mean, Justice. City court if you're in Orleans Parish. And Justice of the Peace Court in Jefferson, and Justice of the Peace Court wherever, you know, most other parishes, and file the eviction and say, look, I'm filing the eviction. Here are the guidelines. I've asked them to provide me with documentation. They can't and haven't. And so, you know, I would like possession. And, you know, then all of a sudden the burden becomes on the other side. Now, what is the judge going to say, hey, look, here's a form. Fill this out. You know, and now all of a sudden you've kind of taken those steps and gone there down to court, and it's you know, all for naught. But again, they may not be able to confirm that. They might be working. They might be working for cash. And you know, if it gets to the point where you've been out of your money for 6 months to a year, and they haven't been paying anything, it might behoove you to hire a private investigator and see if somebody's going to work every day. And now all of a sudden, when they come back and say, yeah, I'm jobless, you know, get your private investigator up there to show that they're not. And, you know, it might cost you $1,000, but it's well worth it if now all of a sudden you can cut the bleeding on this. And, you know, and then the question becomes after that, who do I rent it to now, right? So it's a lot of problems with it. And, you know, stroke of the pen, executive orders, I mean, I think, when the government is mandating shutdowns and won't let people go back to work, you know, it's a problem. And I think the government realizes that, you know, we're not letting people go to work. So we can't let them get kicked out and become homeless, you know, and move to San Francisco, you know.
Question, where would you get the documentation forms of, like, you're qualified for protection on the moratorium?
You can go on the internet and just look up eviction moratorium, and they'll have forms that the government has provided, and you can print them out and say, look, you got to fill this out. Or, you know, depending, you leave it incumbent upon your tenant to produce that, you know, and say, hey, look, where's your proof that you're unemployed? Where's your proof this and this? And you know, I mean, I've been very fortunate. I've got some rental units, and most of the folks that are in there are in the construction business, and so they're all working. You know, they're all paying their rent. They're all, you know, it's very. I've been very. You know, one of them's a nurse. You know, so everybody that you know. That rents one of my units is essential.
Yeah, I think one of the now there's always two sides of unintended consequences. I mean, government has generally good intentions, but often there's a lot of unintended consequences that occur in connection with very extreme government action. And this is something that's not talked about, that I'm probably going to be very unpopular for talking about, but it does happen, is especially when they had the enhanced unemployment benefits, where you had, you know, $900 a week for most people who applied. Well, what happened was some of the tenants understood there's a moratorium, even though they did have the money to pay. And they said, we're not paying. because they can't get us out. I mean, there was a class of tenants who did that. And then, you know, when the lease run and when the moratoriums lift, the intention is to go live somewhere else. Right. So it's, you know, that's one part of this that has never been talked about, that it is occurring. And I'm not, and there's a lot of situations. Each fact is different and each situation is different. But all I am pointing out is that there is unintended consequences. And
I still have clients that are in the restaurant hospitality industry, and they told me we have jobs that we cannot fill to this date. That people just aren't coming back because they're getting extended benefits. They're getting, you know, a new stimulus. They're going to extend the unemployment benefits. So basically what's happened is, why am I going to go to work every day when I can sit home? And in many cases over the summer, they made more money than they would have made going back to work. And so they had no incentive. You know, I mean, people are going to do what is best for them financially, right? And so they're going to sit at home or maybe go work for cash on the side somewhere and get paid this extra stimulus money and not go to work. And meanwhile, these restaurants that are opening, that are doing to-go orders, that are functioning and trying to, you know, make a living and make a go of it, they are struggling to find people to come to work because the government's just paying them to sit around and do nothing. There's a balance there. And there are not enough jobs to fill all of the positions. I mean, there are too many people out there that are out of work to fill these positions. But when you give a disincentive for people to go back to work, they're not going to go back to work.
Can I ask another question? Regard to stimulus payments and all that, would that come into the equation of, you know, when they fill out their qualification form for the moratorium, they have to declare that income? And secondly, it's like really not a good time to buy like a double or something like that, especially if one of the tenants is behind on their rent. You go to act a sale and like, okay, you take over this 30-day month-to-month lease, and you can't evict them.
Well, the only reason it would be good to buy them right now is because they're probably way below market value because there's not a market that they were maybe a year ago for those type of a lot of units that have those type of problems. Jimmy, thanks for the call. Let's go to a break. Doug Santeri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Santeri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers. Albert, I think the callers are taking your advice. They don't want to listen to us talk sports, and they're calling in. So let's go to Jerome's got a question.
That's what we're here for.
That's right. Got a question regarding new construction. Hey, Jerome, you on all things legal with Doug Santeri and Albert Nico.
Good morning. Happy New Year. Actually, it wasn't new construction. Two quick questions. One, piggybacking off of what you all just were speaking about with the rent. I own a home that I rent out to a person. And the question is, this rent that I have is not a contract deal. It's just a month-to-month deal, meaning there's no paperwork or anything. I'm just allowing them to stay there, and they pay monthly. So the first question is, does those moratoriums and things of that nature apply to that situation? That's the first question. And the second question is, I purchased a home in La Place about 4 months ago, and you know, I have a little leak in the shower. And my question is, can I hold the seller liable for that leak? The work was done. He mentioned that the work was done about 18 or 19 months ago. Can I hold that contractor or seller to that leak, that shower leak?
Okay. Yeah, let's talk about your first question. So, yeah, month-to-month rent is, you know, you still have to file an eviction to take possession. And so with a moratorium on evictions, whether or not it's a contract or not, I mean, an oral contract in Louisiana is an oral contract. So you can have a oral or verbal contract, then you're here month to month. And until you're evicted, until someone seeks possession, of the premises until the landlord seeks possession or the tenant, decides to move out. We're here and we have a contract, and you're gonna just pay me on the first whatever that monthly amount is, and we'll move forward from there. So the simple answer is yes, it does apply to month-to-month leases.
So you're saying that I'm not to collect I'm not to collect rent from them under this program?
No, you can pay your rent. Again, you got to make them kind of go through the steps of filling out the form to confirm that, A, they've lost their job and they cannot pay the rent, and, they have a certain income.
They're self-employed, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, so that's going to make it, if they're self-employed, it's going to make it a little harder for you to establish that they didn't lose their job, because they can go to work every day and not tell anybody. So, mm-hmm. You never know. And if you were listening earlier, you may want to hire a private investigator to come along and follow that person if he's claiming, I don't work. And then all of a sudden you see him at a construction site or whatever the case may be, going to work and getting paid. Well, then, you have some pretty good evidence to bring to an eviction hearing saying, well, he claims he's not working, but, here he is going to work every day. And so you kind of set them up for it. You ask them a bunch of questions and, let them hang themselves. And so that's an option. On the sale issue, was this a new home?
No. It was a renovated property.
It's a renovated property. And the person that renovated it is the person that sold it to you?
So they flipped it. The guy that renovated it was the one that the seller hired the contractor to renovate it for him, and I bought the property, but it was completed 18 months ago.
Yeah, that's a little tougher, because the work was done so far back, it might be a little harder. Now, if the seller was in fact the contractor on the job, and didn't pull permits and, all that sort of thing. And you can investigate that through the parish. They didn't pull permits and they basically went put lipstick on a pig. Then that seller has a little more culpability in responding to those issues. And so you have 5 years to sue a contractor for defective work, whether it's a plumbing contractor or whatever the case may be. Now, not for new homes, so don't get confused, but for renovations and for work done on your property, if it's negligence and they've done negligent work, do you know what the cause of the leak is and why it's leaking?
I don't know. I know it's a shower leak on the second floor, and it appears to be coming, off the ceiling. So it may be a drain or something of that nature.
Yeah.
But the gentleman that told, I'm sorry, yeah, in the shower pan.
Mm-hmm.
Gentleman that sold the property, he hired the contractor. He wasn't the contractor. He hired a contractor,
right.
And the work was done, like I said, about 18 months ago.
Okay, so give a call to the seller and say, look, hey, who's the name of this contractor you hired? I'd like to call him back out. And the guy might tell you to, jump in the lake, or he might come back out and try to, see, at least investigate what the work was and what the problem was. And, see if you can get things done that way. He might be willing to work with you and get it done for costs or whatever the case may be, if it looks like it was something that they did wrong. But, and then again, it's depending on how much it's going to cost to repair. That's kind of the tipping point as to whether or not you get an attorney involved, because it's going to cost you money to pursue your claim. So if it's a couple of $1,000 to fix and you can get this guy to help you do it, then, it might be your best route. But he doesn't have, the contractor doesn't have any liability to you, really, because he didn't work for you. he worked for someone else. And so, but, you know, he might want to, his reputation, hey, look, you know, let me see what the problem is and we'll come fix it. And he'll send his guy over there. You never know. So just that's where I would start. Just contacting the prior owner.
Bye-bye.
All right, well, let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyer, is all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyer, is all things legal. Got a couple of minutes before the break. Let's go to Paris. Got a question regarding successions from Marrero. Hey, Paris, you're in all things legal. What you doing? What's happening, Paris?
Hey, good morning, guys. Top of the morning to you and Al and Greg. Quick question. Well, nothing's quick these days. I had opened succession on grandmother and grandfather that both passed. Grandmother passed in 09. She spent 11 years in a nursing home. And back in the days, they had, to my understanding, that's why I'm calling you. They said after you spent so much time in a home that, you know, whenever they would sell the house, that me and my little brother's now looking to sell the house, that the state would get her half, we was told. And I opened succession on both of them, my grandmother and my grandfather. My grandfather died with COVID-19 in June, and now the house is up for sale. I guess my question is, when we opened succession on both of them, everything came out, you know, with nothing on it. I just opened succession. How would we find out, and when would we find out, when we sell the house and go to a title place, and then we would find out?
Well, what they would do is a couple of things. First of all, they can't take half the home. All right, that's a misconception. They can take a 30. They can take a percentage of it, based on the average assessed value in each particular parish. So they're not going to take the, you know, half a home. Now the other part: were both your mom and dad, were they recipients of Medicaid, long term care?
My grandmother, not my grandfather.
Okay, so first of all, so half of the house is your grandfather's.
Yes,
so
sir.
That's not subject to a Medicaid lien. Okay, that's his half. So your grandmother's half, there could only be a certain percentage of that. So that just so you know that. You would find out when Medicaid sends a lien letter.
And they never yet done that. And she's been passed since 09, 11 years.
Well, I think you're okay. Don't mention your grandmother's name so that they don't look it up. But I will say it this way, okay, and this is not legal advice. Bureaucratic inefficiency works both ways. Bureaucratic inefficiency is not fun when government has something you want and you try to get it back, such as a refund or some type of asset they have that they should not have, and you ask for it back and you pull your hair out trying to get it back. But on the other hand, the government inefficient, you know, bureaucratic inefficiency involves sometimes that they technically may have a right to seek reimbursement, and due to the inefficient nature of many government agencies, they don't do it. So I'll leave it at that. I'm not, you know, I can't say, but that's the reality of the situation. So after 9 years, I think you're okay.
Have you opened succession? You've opened the succession on both?
Yes, sir, on both of them. And, you know, after it filed to the courts, you know, of course, nothing came back. Then I was only thinking the only third stage would be after we would sell the home, when we went to the title place, is that the last chance that something would come up?
Well, the attorney handling the succession should be able to, what parish? So they should be able to go to Jeff Netta online if they have a subscription, and you know just do a cursory check, you know, on the title as to what's been filed in the record with the clerk's office and on the mortgage with the mortgage, and then they will be able to determine whether or not, at least from that check, without examining the records personally, just to see what has been recorded and put into the computer, which is usually pretty accurate in Jefferson Parish. You'll be able to determine whether or not there's any type of lien, and you can determine that before you go to active sale.
Yeah, plus you would have received, someone would have received a letter before the lien was put on there, because what would happen is Medicaid would issue a letter saying, You know, so we understand so-and-so passed, that they have paid out X amount of government benefits, and it's basically a reimbursement letter that would precede the actual notice or some type of lien.
Yes, sir.
So you know, I would just proceed, and you know, it's
keep going forward. Just keep going forward.
How about this? Keep your head down and keep going forward.
Look, guys, and also I wanted to thank y'all for all the information that y'all help out, because a lot of times I listen to y'all religiously. I listen to y'all a lot. I even tell my friends, man, throwing WDL is something that somebody's Xing that, you know, you was Xing me. And so y'all help out so many listeners that don't even call, that they're getting information from somebody else, and they might be in the same situation or just trying to grasp, you know, information that y'all giving out. And it's really good. It's powerful information y'all giving out to people. And I want to thank y'all for the great job y'all doing.
Hey, Paris, that's very kind of you. And just give me your address, and I'll send you a check.
Yes, sir. I'm waiting for my stimulus.
All right. There you go. All right. That's very kind of you, Paris.
Thank you. Have a beautiful day.
Thanks, Carl. We got about 40 seconds before we go to national news and local news. But that's one of the, you know, Albert, one of the things about, you know, government, and if, you know, they're just not maybe efficient in certain areas that they should. And that's probably one of them.
Yeah,
so,
you know,
one of the many.
2009, they were not as interested in collecting back that money.
They're a lot more now since the government is broke. So they're a lot more on top of that issue. So, all right. Well, we're going to go to national news. We're going to go to local news. And we'll come back for hour number two on all things legal. So stay tuned. Doug Sundari, Albert Nico. We're making the complex understandable. See you in about 10 minutes. Hey, we're back. Doug Sundari, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal, back for hour number two. And on 10 o'clock, we're in our 13th season. We're making the complex understandable. Let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Tim in Thibodeau. He's got a question regarding paying college athletes.
Thanks very much. Yes, indeed. This is there ought to be a way, and yes, there is, but it's long, very painful, and ultimately difficult, and so on. We know, and I think you already know, that there's legal action proposed, and they're going to the Supreme Court about paying college athletes. A stipend, at least. And I just wanted to get your reactions to it. I have personal situations from LSU and from Nicholls State. I was with Donald Ray Kennard for a number of years at LSU doing the undergraduate and some graduate, you know, advising. And did the same thing at Nicholls and was the academic advisor. The problem in both cases, whether it's SEC or Southland, were multiple, and quite a bit of time the athletes were, you know, taken advantage of. They walked away. They walked away without a degree. They walked away without an AA. And ultimately, they didn't get much for all that they put in. And I don't know if it was all their fault or not. You know, double abuse all the way around. For example, I tutored Maravich once upon a time. He didn't need it. They showed me his paper. He only had two or three very minor errors. He was in remedial. Mm-hmm. Press had put him there because wanted to make sure he made his grades. Now, he ultimately left LSU 16 hours short. Mm-hmm. That probably didn't need to happen, but it didn't make much difference because he was a superstar and everything else. We know that. But how many college athletes make it to the pros like that? What is it? I think the percentages are still below double figures, aren't they?
Well, so much less. Man, you raise a lot of really good issues. And I'm glad you messed press, because I used to work for Coach J. So you knew Coach J. McCreary back then.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh.
So, yeah. And his son, J. McCreary, is also an attorney.
Right.
And well, a couple of things, first of all. And, you know, Dale Brown told me this in the mid-1980s. He said, I think one day college athletes are going to strike. Now, there's a couple of arguments to this on both sides, and I'll present both of them. If you get a scholarship at Tulane, okay, that's a $250,000 value to play.
That's correct.
And so that's a lot of value there. Coach Brown's problem was, even though the players were receiving some value for their scholarship, that there was a disproportionate amount of money that was being made off of the players. So the players were getting a scholarship while networks, universities were making $1 billion, billions and billions of dollars. He says at some point the athletes are going to acknowledge that. Now, they started having litigation with the video games when they were using the images of video games of the players, and the players were not getting anything. And so now there's some provision for that. Now, I'll give you another interesting history about college athletics as far as the money's concerned. Back in the 1990s, we used to do licensing we did licensing with LSU, Ohio State, Texas A&M, a lot of the big universities. And when we would do licensing for LSU, we would go to the assistant chancellor's assistant secretary, put the license in front of their, and they would sign off on it. Now I think you have 3 or 4 floors in the LSU athletic complex on marketing and licensing. So the money is big, and there's a disproportionate amount of money that is being made by everyone else besides, in comparison to the athletes, even though the athletes do get a good deal by getting a free education, but they work, and they work hard.
Absolutely.
And I think also what Coach Brown used to say, which is debatable, but he had said, even if an athlete, and a lot of them came from urban areas who would never have gone to college anyway, and spent 2 years at LSU and left, they would still be better off for being in that situation than not being there at all. At least there was some
in that college environment.
Yeah, benefit from that. So it's a very complex question that you raise.
Yeah. And let me give you the reverse side of the argument.
Okay.
I've got at least 60 to 90 players up and down this bayou who did not make it at all, and they left the university without taking a degree.
Yes.
They had maybe enough hours, but they didn't have it in the right places. They didn't finish their English 102. They didn't finish a math that they needed or whatever. During the semester, I'm told, get them eligible. They got to have 12 hours with a 2.0. We don't care how you do it, do it. And when I'd set up the ideal situation, that wouldn't work because, no, I don't want to go there. I don't want to go there. I don't want to go there. Well, what happened is we ended up with one of the Nichols' best basketball players was destined for pro contract, everything else, hurt his knee out of it. The last time he was doing groceries down the bayou. Now he's at least got a job at Bollinger or something like that.
Yeah,
but right. A lot of these kids, I mean, they don't have a lot of money, and their time is really constrained, as you well know, because of the rigors of athletics. But they leave school, and I was thinking perhaps there could be something for now and something in escrow where the now would be for the immediate and the family, because a lot of them had family needs, and the escrow could be incentive-driven, where if they finished at least an AA. Now, back in the oil boom situation, the oil folks didn't care whether somebody had an AA, an AS, or a BA. It didn't matter, as long as they had Nichols State University on it or LSU on it with an AA, they'd take them, period. And at least they had an outlet for a career. And further, if you had an AA degree, you could come back and you had that 60 hours collected in a box. You could go anywhere and continue your education.
Well,
but none of that is possible, you know, for a lot of them. They just leave and they never come back. And on paper, and I taught technical writing for years at LSU and at Nichols, on paper, they're no better than a high school graduate because they don't have any college degree whatsoever.
Well, you know, it's you bring up some really great points, and I would say a couple of things. One, I think it was proposed that if you know that they would have some type of bank for college athletes to finish their college education, at least give them an opportunity. If you got a scholarship, that there's going to be money allocated to you to finish within a certain amount of time. The other thing is athletes are under the illusion that they're going to play professional sports, and that's only like 0.1, 1% at best.
That's what I was thinking.
And even if you do play college sport, pro sports, you're going to be broke after you're finished if you do not know how to wisely manage your life and manage your money and manage your responsibilities, which college does teach you. Now, I would say that if Coach Brown was listening, I think he would agree with me on this one, and this is the fact. College athletics is a form of mutual exploitation on both ways. I mean, both parties exploit each other. You're looking at college athletes right now. I mean, Coach Ogeron has to recruit him to stay at LSU, go to LSU, stay at LSU, and re-recruit him all through the year. And that's not good. I don't think that's good, but that's the way it is. And then, of course, the administrators and the networks and, the licensing, they're exploiting the athletes. So it's mutual exploitation right now. And it often turns out bad for both sides. Now, let me ask you this. How's Coach Rebo doing down in Nickel State?
He's been doing fine. I wish we could have played LSU this year, frankly.
Yeah. I tell you,
That did not happen. And no, he's doing fine. And they finally have raised his salary to be more commensurate with other Southland universities and everything like that. So it's working out better. We'll see next year. By the way, Ogeron did take one of the Nichols graduate students who was going to stay here, and when they killed the program because of the epidemic, he moved on to LSU and played some linebacker for LSU. Actually, not this current year, but the year before. I think he was actually on that national championship squad.
Yeah, well, Nichols has got a great tradition of players. They go back to Gary Barbaro, I think Anthony
Barbaro,
Bay.
Yeah, sure.
They got Anthony Bay. He played for Pittsburgh. Then they had at the time.
Well, I tutored Jay Pennison. He played 13 years for the Houston Oilers.
Yeah, I had Terrence Cooks when I was there, when I was an agent. Terrence Cooks.
Oh, Cookie Man. He was something else.
He was. I will tell you an interesting story about Terrence. He was one of the top linebackers in the nation when he was being recruited. He was being recruited by Tom Osborne, Dick Vermeil, and a few other, all over the nation. Well, he lived in Pankerville.
That's right.
And he loved his mama's cooking, if he missed Ida Cooks. And so he did not want to leave, because I think Pankerville is only about 30 miles from Thibodaux. He did not want to leave mama's cooking. So when Dick Vermeil said, "Son, where are you going to go to school?" He said, "Nickel State." And Dick Vermeil said, "In all my years of recruiting, I've never lost anybody to Nickel State." So that was a first.
Well, let me please tell you one. Terrence Cook showed up at a friend of mine who was advising in freshman division.
Yeah.
And he had cut some classes, and Cookie Man was known for his smile,
yes,
regardless.
Yes, yes.
And so anyhow, she, as well as she could, reamed him up one side and down the other. And when she finished, he looked at her and smiled and said, "Ms. Menzies, thank you. I deserve that." And she had to run all the way to the bathroom. She was laughing so hard.
Yeah, he was good. He was good. And they had one of the great defensive backs in CFL was Kent Leonard, Catfish Leonard. He played in the 1990s. So Nickel State has a great tradition. Coach Phil Greco, who's from New Orleans, coached there for a long
time. I know Phil very well. Yeah.
So they have a great tradition. And I tell you what, I went to LSU with Tim, and he's a great, great coach. And he's going to take Nickel State to one, semifinals or finals in the playoff. He's that good. All right. Well, thank man. You brought up some great topics. Please call again. I enjoy talking to you. I could probably take 2 hours talking about that.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to a break. Ducks and Terry, Albert Nico, your Weekend Lawyers. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Ducks and Terry, Albert Nico, your Weekend Lawyers. All things legal. We got Kenny from Abita Springs in God's Country on the line. Got a construction question, which Albert's going to take.
I do. Are y'all there?
Yeah. What you got for us, Kenny?
Hey, look. Okay, here we go. I'm looking to hire someone to do some work on my house, and he doesn't have insurance. He does great work and nice guy and all that, but he has no insurance. He's willing to sign a paper that would leave me, you know, not responsible for anything if it happened. But I'm more worried about him getting injured than anything else. Where we go from here?
Unfortunately, as the owner, you can't really contract out of workers' comp benefits, right? But if you can hire him, and so the way to do this properly is to hire him not by the hour, hire him on a contract basis, where it's a set, you know, scope of work for a set price. So then you can establish.
Well, he's talking about by the day. By the day he's talking about.
Yeah.
How much a day?
When you talk about by the day, you're really kind of talking about wages and not so much a contract services.
Okay.
And so to make that distinction, you'll want to say, look. Contractor, how many days do you think it's going to take you to do X? And then,
right.
You know, hey, look, well, it's X, and then we'll have a little contract prepared that I will perform this work for X amount of dollars, or, you know. And so now all of a sudden, you know, he's not your hourly or day laborer type employee. And so that brings brings him more out of the element of your employee. An independent contractor who's performing a service for a price. That's the first thing. And then, you know, will he be having any employees, or he's just a solo guy?
He's by himself. He has his wife that helps him.
Mm-hmm.
He likes there to go buy Pete, you know, parts and stuff like that. So
sure. Yeah, that's okay. I think you'd be in good shape. Even if you purchase the materials and say, you know, gave it a labor only price, again, I think it brings it a little bit further away from the workers' comp field, where, you know, you're paying him as an employee. You know, so you get into this, you get into these tests. You know, number one, will you be supervising the work? Will you be directing the work? Will you be, you know, and all of those things probably are no. You know, hey, look, go build my pantry for $500, and he's going to go build your pantry for $500, and you've got an independent third party contract with someone. But if he's working by the day, it makes it you know, brings you a little closer, and you're going to have to probably pony up in the event he does get injured and doesn't have any kind of health benefits to pay for his injury.
Well, and I want to say this though. That won't stop you from getting sued.
Right. Well, of course not.
Yeah. I mean, and there's always that risk. And also, too, when you're doing that, you just need to know there's certain things you can do that Albert's suggesting to mitigate that argument. But it's not going to stop you from getting sued, and it's not 100% foolproof.
He said he would sign a paper. He was signing a paper that says he wouldn't sue, he wouldn't hold me, you know, reliable for anything.
That doesn't
do the work. He does great work. That's the thing.
Sure. And that's something that you can, you know, it's just another little part of the test, right? So it's not
right.
Every time they evaluate these issues, they evaluate it and it's fact-based. So if you have something else, you know, in his contract, maybe a paragraph that says, you know, I'm an independent contractor. This is not created employer-employee relationship, you know, all that sort of thing. And then that brings it, you know, it's just something else in the event he does choose to sue you. Hey, look, you know, we've agreed to this. We made sure it's by the job. It's for a flat price, et cetera, et cetera. Right. You know, so you're kind of going through the test and confirming that, you know, and look, and he even agreed to it. So he, it's nothing, no surprise to him either, right?
Right. Now, should that should be notarized or anything like that, or what?
No. Have a contract between the two of you signed, dated, and, you know, you should be good to go.
Yeah.
Okay.
It provides you insulation, but it's not 100% foolproof.
I had a guy years ago tell me, look, I need you to, you know, prepare a contract for me where I can't get sued. I'm like, I could prepare a contract for you where you're probably going to win, but anybody can sue anybody for any reason, and you might have to hire a lawyer, you know, to in if it's a bogus lawsuit, there's a better chance of you getting out at an earlier stage of the litigation. But that caveat's always the case. Anybody can sue you for anything. Whether or not they have merits, and you have to, you know, buck up and get a lawyer to come defend you, right?
All right.
Well, thanks for the info.
Thanks for the call, absolutely. Kenny. Enjoy God's country and Abita Springs. Okay, let's go to Joseph. Got a child support question. Hey, Joseph, you on All Things Legal with Ducks and Terry Albert Nico.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are y'all?
Good. What's happening, Joseph?
Well, child support question. Been divorced 10 years, and during the majority of that, 50-50 on custody. Mm-hmm. Had about a $25,000 a year difference in salaries during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I did pay child support.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 2 years ago, I retired. After I retired, the ex received 25% of my retirement, which that's been going on for the last 2 years. Yeah. Now, after I retired and she received 25% of my retirement, it basically reversed. In other words, her income went up about $18,000 a year gross. And of course mine went down, which basically it reversed. Her income increased, mine decreased. And so now, she has claimed to me that, even though she's receiving that additional income, it doesn't apply to child support.
All right.
And so that's my question.
Okay. Well, how old's your child?
16.
All right. Well, first of all, you only have 2 years left because when the child,
yes, sir.
So when the child makes 18, that's an interesting question because that doesn't happen too often. The 25% she's getting from your retirement is actually from your community property settlement. Because what happened was, is y'all were obviously married for half of your time, your service with your employer.
Oh, yes, sir. I understand that. Yep.
And so, you know, that's and she's saying because it's part of a community property asset that's being paid out, that should not kind of get income.
Let me ask you, would his income from retirement be counted? Because if his income from the retirement counted,
yeah, but it's low. But his retirement income is less because he's retired. He doesn't make as much money as he did before.
My point is, if they're counting his retirement income, why wouldn't they count the income?
Well, what she's trying to say is the argument is, and I don't agree with it, but it's a good try, is to say that that was part of a payout of a community property settlement, the pension. Is based on what happens is, I'll make it very simple. Let's say someone was working for Entergy for 40 years, okay, and they were married for 20 and they divorced. Well, basically, the spouse would be entitled to, if they had a pension, one half of the pension because they were married for 40 years. They were married for half the time of the service that. Entergy is community property, so you get a half of a half, which would be a fourth. I did that very quickly. But So what she's trying to say is because that's a payout on a community property asset, that that shouldn't be counted as income for the purposes of calculating child support. Now, you've had two things going on. First of all, you receive, you have more or less total income because you've retired, because people generally don't make more. Plus, you have 25% of your retirement going to your ex-wife, so therefore you make less money. That's one basis for reducing child support. And the other basis is the fact that she's receiving 25% more income from your retirement. I would say that that's not a valid argument. You go based on whatever income she's receiving right now versus your income. And if she's receiving more than you are and you're on worksheet B, which is the 50-50 shared custody worksheet, you should be, you may be able to, you may be entitled to child support. Now, who's covering the health insurance for the child?
I am.
Okay, so you get a credit for that. So you get a credit for that also. So I would say she what you would have to do is you would have to file a petition to modify child support. What parish are you in?
East Baton Rouge.
Okay, East Baton Rouge. I think they have a – do they have hearing officers there?
I'm not sure.
No, I don't think they do. I don't think they do.
Yeah.
I don't think they do.
You know, so, I'm not interested even in turning the script to receive from the ex. My argument was is that it is counted as income.
It's a good argument.
And as such, I don't have to pay child support because it increased substantially and mine decreased substantially. In fact, far below what her income is now.
But
has been claimed for 2 years.
But you have to go to court to get it changed.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, yes, sir. I understand. And I told her basically, you know, we can go to court if you like, but there's no way it's not counted as income.
Right. It's counted. I understand her argument. I think your argument prevails.
Yes, sir.
But what you have to do, though, according to the court, you still owe that child support until you change it. So you have to file a petition to modify. Now, whether you want to try to collect from her or stop it, that's up to you. But you have to file a petition if y'all don't agree, because that, even though you're in that situation, if you don't modify that judgment, the change of situation doesn't apply until that judgment is modified officially by filing a petition for modification. Yeah.
Well, there was never a judgment for me to pay child support.
Well, just don't. Okay, here's what I would do then. Don't pay, and then let her bring you to court. All right.
Yeah. No, I'm not. I'm not paying anything else, and haven't been for over 2 years.
All right. Well, you can cite us as your source.
Yeah.
All right. Cite me as your source in that. But just don't tell them how much you paid to get it, so she'll believe it. So anyway.
Well, thank you for your time.
All right. Thanks for the call. All right. Let's go to a break. Doug Santeri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyer, is making the complex understandable. We'll be right back after this timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Santeri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right. Let's go to Barbara. She's on the phone. Miss Barbara, you're on all things legal. What can we do for you?
Yes, good morning. I'm calling to ask, what are the timelines for returning tenants their deposit back? And are there a grace period if the landlord are trying to clear some debt, mainly utility bills?
Albert?
The tenant makes.
Okay, so you're asking about security deposits paid to a landlord, or are you asking about utility deposits?
No, security deposit that's paid to the landlord, but the tenant has.
Right. So what happens is at the end of the lease term, the landlord, what a tenant is supposed to do is provide the landlord with a set of keys and a forwarding address. Hey, I'm moving to this place. The landlord then has 30 days to send the deposit return. And if they don't do it within 30 days, then there's attorney's fees and penalties and everything else that Or attached to that. Now, what they have to do also, if there is some damages or if there are some charges that are going to be charged against the deposit, within that 30-day period, they have to send a letter to the tenant at the forwarding address, itemizing each one of the charges. You know, had to clean this, had a broken window, had whatever the case may be, and those charges have to be itemized, and then they have to send the difference. So if it's a $1,000 deposit and there were $500 in damages and in chargebacks, then they have to send that $500 check within the 30 days. And then, of course, you have the right at that point to dispute the holdback, or the tenant would have that right. So, but that's how that works. 30 days, you have to give them forwarding address and, you know, of course, the keys to the premises.
If 30 days pass, what happened? They can do something to the landlord.
What's the remedy?
So after 30 days, if they don't send it to you?
Yes.
Yeah, so if they don't send it to you after 30 days, you contact the landlord and say, you need to send me my security deposit, and if you don't, I'm, you know, going to have to bring an action against you in city court or, you know, wherever the jurisdiction is of the department. And then, you know, you can go to city court, and they have little forms you can fill out to say he didn't pay me my deposit within 30 days, and, you know.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Right. Take care.
All right.
Yeah, and just as a little aside,
yeah,
you know, if you're moving out and you think that it might at all be contentious with the landlord, walk around and snap pictures, you know. Clean the place out, take pictures of the stove. You know, take pictures of the windows and just save them for 30 days on your phone. And then, you know, if you get your deposit back, delete it and it's all done. But you know, just to kind of protect yourself on the front end, you know, when they say, oh, we had to do this, this, and this. Well, you know, here's a picture of the shower. I cleaned it and the bathroom's clean. And this is, you know, this has all been done. And there were no damages. So just a little heads up on the way out if you think it might be a problem.
All right. Thanks for the call, Barbara. So, I tell you what. Let's go to our final break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers. We're making the complex understandable. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. We're about 4 minutes before we call it a day. You know, Albert, 11 years ago from today, hell froze over and pigs flew. Do you know that?
Yeah, that's right.
Saints
won that Super Bowl.
Well, the Vikings. They beat the Vikings to go to Super Bowl.
Oh, that's immortal, right. Yeah, you're right.
In the immortal words of Jim Henderson's, you know, hell froze over and pigs fly, and the
right,
Saints are going
right
to the Super Bowl. So that was 11 years ago. And that's sort of interesting because I think after the Saints won the Super Bowl, we were thinking maybe we'll have two or three in the next couple of years or
right
through the tenure it's not realized on how hard it is to win a Super Bowl. I mean, a lot of great, great teams never get there or never win it.
Yeah. Which makes Brady solidifies him as the greatest ever.
Absolutely.
You can't argue.
Now,
I don't know anyone. If you talk about Joe Montana and all that, no, Tom Brady is the greatest ever.
Also, thanks to Bob Remy in his wonderful book, Louisiana Sports History, which I steal material from on the show all the time. So thank you, Bob. On January 24th, 2013, the New Orleans Hornets changed his name to the Pelicans. So that was
one of the finest logos in the NBA, if you ask me.
I'll tell you an interesting story about the Pelicans. In the mid-1990s, Mr. Benton asked me, he would want to bring a double-A team to New Orleans at the same time the Zephyrs came. I think it was late 90s. So that's one of the things that got him crossways with the state or, you know, with government, is because he wanted to bring a double-A team, I think, from Louisville, if I'm not mistaken. And they ended up bringing the Zephyrs because they were triple-A, but he thought that they should take his team because he already owned the Saints. But he had asked me to go to get the Pelicans. He wanted to call them the New Orleans Pelicans if he brought the baseball team here, because he just loved the name. And he had asked me to go secure the trademark, and I found that a softball team had had the trademark of New Orleans Pelicans at the time. And I didn't want to disclose to the softball team who wanted to buy it, because as soon as they wanted to buy it, the price would shoot up. So I had to go in there very discreetly, and we started negotiations, and they were being a little difficult. And so I think I told him, just go ahead and do it anyway, and you can wear them out in litigation. And they wouldn't be able to sustain. And then that's inside baseball, what lawyers tell clients that they'll never admit on the air. But I said, go ahead and do it, and let's just deal with it on the back end and, you know, see if we can cut a deal. And but that never came to fruition because the New Orleans Zephyrs came. And so that sort of fell off the – but when that fell off the radar. But when people are wondering, you know, as far as Mr. Benson and the Pelicans, he's always liked that name. He's always wanted that name. He's always had a great affinity to it. So when he bought the NBA team, he was able to do that.
It's an historic name, too, right, from the old baseball team and everything else.
Right. Well, New Orleans Pelicans for the baseball team were from 1901 to 1959, and also they played 1 year in the Superdome in 1977. So that's interesting. Now, Hank Aaron died this week also. And do you know, thanks to Bob Remy, Doug Morrow, and others, that Hank Aaron played in Kirsch Rooney 7 days before he set the record in an exhibition game? Did you know that? Against the Baltimore Orioles. 7 days before he broke the record, they played an exhibition game in Kirsch Rooney, and as it was reported, I think he came in the sixth or seventh inning, hit a home run over the, the right left field fence in Kirsch Rooney.
Broke a window at a house two blocks away.
And then jumped in his limousine and headed home. But which is a little baseball history for New Orleans, that Hank Henry Aaron, who died, I think Wednesday at age 86 and 14 days after he took his vaccination for COVID. I'm not saying, I'm just stating facts there. So a little New Orleans history has to do with, Henry Aaron, and then he hit it. I think he hit 714 against Messersmith or Al Downing. I'm not sure. But 715 went in Atlanta was. I remember that. I remember when he hit it. I ran into my dad's mom and dad's bedroom, and I'm screaming, Henry Aaron did it. He did it. And my dad was watching it on his black and white TV.
There you go.
There you go.
I know we only have about a minute or so left, but, earlier we were talking about paying college players.
Yeah.
I'm all for it. You know, the problem is when you pay them a little bit, you can hide a lot more. And so, it's what do you do, right? I mean,
when you pay them none, you can hide a lot too. So.
Well, that's right. Yeah, but I mean, paying something, where'd you get the shoes? $500.
Or they get compensated. All right, we'll see you next week on All Things Legal. Be good and be blessed. Thanks. We'll see you next week.
O'Reilly. Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.